Will your church be one of the issues, etc. 300? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. We're looking for 300 congregations to pledge $1,000 to Issues, etc. in their budgets. To find out more about the Issues, etc. 300, click the support page of our website, issuesetc.org. You'll even find a one-page informational flyer. Please consider including Issues, etc. in your church's mission or advertising budget. The Issues, etc. 300.
Muslims will be coming from not just across the country, but from around the world to participate in the National Day of Islamic Unity.
That's Hassan Abdellah. He's president of Darul Islam Mosque in Elizabeth, New Jersey, and one of the organizers of Capitol Hill's prayer gathering for Muslims, slated to take place Friday there in Washington, D.C. What does it mean that Muslims will gather for prayer and show Islamic unity? What is Islam in the American context? And should there be any concern here when it comes to Muslims gathering, they say, just for prayer, for purely spiritual purposes? Joining us to talk about this Muslim prayer gathering taking place Friday in Washington, D.C., Robert Spencer, director of Jihad Watch, columnist for Human Events and Front Page Magazine. He's author of 9 books on Islam, including his latest, The Complete Infidel's Guide to the Quran. Robert, welcome back.
Thank you. Happy to be back.
If you listen to the press surrounding this this prayer gathering for Muslims in Washington, D.C., sounds a little bit like an upcoming peace rally. Sounds like Islam is just a religion of kind of devout religionists who are going to pray for the betterment of all mankind. Good stuff coming. Does that bear a resemblance to the Islam you've come to know?
No, in fact, and there are some disquieting indications that some of the people behind this prayer event are not interested solely in just praying. One of the leaders of the Quran recitation who's been named at this event is Sheikh Ahmed Dewidar, who is the Imam of Midtown Manhattan's Islamic Center and an Islamic Studies instructor at Manhattanville College. And he is widely reputed to be a moderate, but he was quoted in 2005 in an interview on the Middle East Broadcasting Company, saying that he had heard some imams talking about how the White House would become the Muslim House and America would become an Islamic state. And instead of saying, no, we don't want this, we want a democratic government, we want to coexist with other religions, instead he started talking about how Muslims could most effectively bring that about. And so it's interesting that he's the one chosen to lead the prayers at this thing. That indicates, I think, a supremacist impulse that's in line with what's taught in the Quran and is in line with traditional Islam, but is certainly not in line with the U.S. Constitution.
It strikes me that this is I don't presume to say this is a first of its kind, but it strikes me that we have not heard up to this point very often about Muslims gathering for kind of their national day of prayer, so to speak.
No, this is a first. This is a new thing. As a matter of fact, the organizer of it says that he was inspired by Barack Obama, that Barack Obama's Cairo speech, in which he spoke about the need for Muslims, non-Muslims, to approach Muslims in an atmosphere of respect, he was impressed by this, the organizer of this thing, and so he decided to organize this prayer. And it's interesting that he said that they're going to make the azan, the call to prayer, that sounds from the minarets, the towers outside of mosques in the Islamic world, they're going to make that resound off the Capitol building and the Washington Monument and the White House. That means that they are intending to really make a statement here, that it's going to be a large crowd and they're going to be booming these prayers out, definitely making an assertion about Islam's presence in the United States and its power in the United States.
If we go strictly by what the Quran and the other holy writings of Islam teach the Muslim to believe, how is the Muslim to view himself, let's say a devout Muslim, a Quranic Muslim, in the United States, in the West? How does he view himself? What does he think his place in the world is according to the Quran?
Well, chapter 3, verse 110 of the Quran says that the Muslims are the best of people on earth. And chapter 98, verse 6 of the Quran says that the unbelievers are the most vile of created beings. And so that's a very sharp contrast. And a devout, Quranically knowledgeable Muslim will see that contrast playing out and will make it play out in his daily life such that he will essentially view non-Muslim society and non-Muslims in general with contempt and with enmity and hatred, in fact, as in chapter 60 of the Quran, Muslims are directed to imitate Abraham in his enmity and hatred that he had for his father and his family for refusing to accept Islam. And so non-Muslim society, a lot of people think, well, they'll come here and they'll get comfortable with American pluralism and American tolerance and so on. People don't seem to understand that many of the Muslims who come to the United States are coming out of a vastly different worldview that does not allow for that kind of peaceful coexistence between believers and unbelievers as equals.
So how does the Quran teach the Muslim to regard, I mean, in a nutshell, how does it teach him to regard the non-Muslim?
With this same kind of contempt and hatred, as an inferior, as a renegade, as somebody who is at war with Allah and thus is an enemy also of the Muslims. And so this is something that has to be understood in light of the various calls for negotiations, for negotiated settlements between Israel and the Palestinians, Obama wanting to sit down and talk with the Iranian mullahs. All of this is based on Western ideas of compromise and of coexistence that are not subscribed to in the Quran, and thus it's not likely to succeed, and they never have succeeded so far.
Do you expect to hear the Quranic message at this prayer gathering on Friday of Muslims in Washington, D.C.?
Well, there's no doubt that the Quranic message is going to resound. I mean, they have named the two Quranic reciters who are going to recite Quran. It's going to be recited in Arabic because in traditional Islamic theology, it's not the Quran unless it's in Arabic. And so most Americans are not going to understand what's being said. But the Quran, with its very sharp distinction between believers and unbelievers, is most likely going to be sounding out in Washington words that are frankly and unabashedly supremacist in their import and in their thrust, and that teach that non-Muslims have to are to be regarded with this contempt and hatred and have to submit to the rule of the Muslims as inferiors if they do not wish to convert to Islam.
You have made the case several times in our previous conversations that the Quran teaches what is essentially a totalitarian worldview with Islam as its center. Make that case, if you would.
Well, that's very much the case, that Islam teaches that it is wrong to question, that it is dangerous to one's faith to question it. It teaches that one must obey a ruler, even if he's a bad ruler. And so it also teaches, above all, I should add, that Allah, the supreme God, is in control of everything. And as being in control of everything, he holds the destinies of all people in his hand, even to the extent of guiding some people away from the truth and damning them to hell. And so this inculcates a kind of fatalism into the Islamic consciousness. And you don't find a strong work ethic in the Islamic world. You find, in contrast, a passivity that is rooted in this fatalism and destroys individual initiative. And so this is one of the reasons why Islamic societies don't prosper. In the past, when they have built great Islamic empires, it was when there were significant minorities of non-Muslims who financed essentially those empires with the taxes that they paid to the Islamic State. But when those communities became exhausted financially and culturally, then those great Islamic empires began to go into decline.
And yet Islam still teaches that kind of the ultimate goal is global Islam, doesn't it?
That's correct. But essentially, the idea that all the world will be Muslim is something that is considered to come only in the end times. Because before that, really, Islam needs non-Muslims to support it. As a matter of fact, Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, is very, very clear in an Islamic tradition that Muslims have to be sure to collect the special tax that is levied on non-Muslims by the Quran, because that's the source of their livelihood. And it is that kind of a culture that is inculcated by the Quran, one that is a culture of raiding and of taking what belongs to others, not a culture in which one works and produces fruits of one's own labors.
We're talking about a Muslim prayer gathering taking place Friday in Washington, D.C. Robert Spencer is our guest, director of Jihad Watch, columnist for Human Events and Front Page Magazine. He's author of 9 books on Islam, including his latest, The Complete Infidel's Guide to the Quran. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on demand and look for The Complete Infidel's Guide to the Quran by our guest, Robert Spencer. When we come back, more on the Muslim prayer gathering and what we can expect to hear, albeit perhaps in Arabic, from the Muslims who gather in Washington, D.C. on Friday. You can join us with questions or comments. Our email address on this Tuesday afternoon, September the 22nd, talkback at issuesetc.org. Talkback at issuesetc.org. If you're following us at Twitter, our address at issuesetc, or give us a call, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. When we come back, more with Robert Spencer of Jihad Watch, author of The Complete Infidel's Guide to the Quran, among his many other books on Islam. We'll talk about the goal of Islam in the United States. Where do we go to find out what Muslims want for the future of the U.S.? I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. 1-877-623-6943. 1-877-623-MYIE.
Thanks to God's gift of the internet, people are listening to Issues Etc. around the world.
From Japan to Oslo, Norway, here is Simon. Simon, welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, I want to vote for Benny Hinn. My reason for doing so is because, Jesus, the second Adam, ascended to heaven, so I guess there's some truth to it.
Thank you very much. Apparently they have senses of humor in Norway. Thank you very much for listening in Norway.
Christ-centered, cross-focused talk radio for the world. Issues Etc.
Here's a new way to stay connected to Issues Etc. Check out our page on Facebook. Network with fellow Issues Etc. junkies. Sign up to become a fan, and we'll send you updates on future topics and guests. You'll even find photos of in-studio guests, Todd drinking chelada, and highlights from our one-year anniversary open house. You'll discover that Todd, Jeff, and Craig really do have faces for radio on Facebook. Issues Etc. on Facebook. Another way to stay connected to Issues Etc. Facebook.com/issuesetc.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Where does your state rank?
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Americans United for Life recently released its 2009 rankings of states based on the number and nature of state laws restricting abortion, stem cell research, and physician-assisted suicide. The most pro-life state in the union is Pennsylvania, followed by Louisiana, South Dakota, Oklahoma, Mississippi, Texas, North Dakota, and Nebraska. The abortion rate in these states has declined nearly 20% in the last decade, thanks in part to pro-life legislation. The least pro-life state in America is California. Hawaii ranks second, followed by Vermont, New Jersey, Connecticut, Nevada, Oregon, New York, Washington, and Illinois.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
There's no political protest, no political statements, no placards, none of that. We're there for one purpose and one purpose alone, spiritual.
That's Hassan Abdallah, president of Darul Islam Mosque in Elizabeth, New Jersey, organizer of the Capitol Hill prayer gathering for Muslims on Friday. Robert Spencer is our guest. In about 15 minutes, we'll talk with Dr. Andrew Steinman about Jonah. Robert, we hear it's an apolitical, I mean, that's the claim here, an apolitical gathering of prayer for these Muslims on Friday in Washington, D.C. Can you separate the, quote, spiritual from the political in Islam?
No, and in any other context, Muslims would be proudly avowing that. One of the key elements of Islamic apologetic against the Judeo-Christian West is that Islam makes no distinction between the sacred and the secular. Religious law is intended to rule over all of society. Islamic law is political in its extent, not just religious. And Muslim writers in the 20th century very proudly avowed this and said this was a sign of Islam being superior to the Judeo-Christian Western framework. And so then you have this prayer that is solely going to be religious and not political. It indicates a little bit of disingenuousness, at very least, because I'm sure that Hassan Abdallah knows that Islam is political in its extent, that it is a political and social system as well as an individual religious faith. And so he's it doesn't inspire trust in me when I hear him saying this, because he must know that any Islamic religious statement is ipso facto political, that it does have a political extent. That's not me talking. That is the record of Islam throughout history and the clear teachings of Islamic spokesmen even to this day.
You mentioned disingenuousness, and it seems to be the order of the day for the popular spokespeople in American Islam. Why and where do we go to get the truth if this is in fact disingenuousness?
Well, there's a great deal of disinformation and misinformation being spread about Islam in America today. And so that's why when I write my books about Islam and jihad and the threat of Islamic supremacism, I document everything. And everything is clear from the footnotes as to the source. And I invite anyone and everyone to look into the sources and to see that these things really are there and that I'm not exaggerating and I am not sensationalizing and I'm not fabricating. All these things are in the sources. The Quran does teach warfare against unbelievers and their subjugation. And these things have to be recognized as matters of public policy, that the more we ignore it, the more we'll be blindsided by challenges and threats from sources we did not want to acknowledge. And so it's very important that we look into the Islamic sources, into the Quran. But 8 years after 9/11, this is the most notable omission of our response to the jihad threat.
I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. live this Tuesday afternoon, the 22nd of September. Robert Spencer, author of the new book, The Complete Infidel's Guide to the Quran, is our guest. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-MY-IE, 877-623-6943. Our in-studio email address, talkback at issuesetc.org, or Twitter us at issuesetc. Here's Herman listening in Illinois. Hi, Herman.
Thank you for taking my call. Dr. Spencer, in describing the coming militancy of this Islamic event, is there any possibility that behind it there is a stockpiling of weapons among these Muslims to prepare for actual warfare on this continent?
Thank you very much.
No doubt about it. I'm not saying that weapons are being stockpiled by any particular group here or there, but there continue to be jihad plots that are being uncovered. We have now in the news just the last few days this elaborate plot that seems to have stretched between Denver, Colorado, and New York City of Islamic jihadists who were planning to target sports stadiums and Fashion Week in New York City with knapsack bombs, evidently to be activated by remote control. And so is there still planning for havoc and violence to be wreaked in the name of Islamic Jihad in the United States? Most certainly. And we certainly have not seen the last of it.
Don in Junction City, Kansas, emails with the question, is it true that Allah is an Arabian moon god? Is it true that Islam forbids him to make forbids the Muslim from making friends with Christians or Jews? Two questions there. What about Allah as moon god?
Okay, There was a God, Allah, that predates Islam. But at the same time, Christians and Jews who spoke Arabic and who speak Arabic today refer to God, the supreme God, the God of the Bible, as Allah. And so the word itself, I think people often read too much into it when they're dealing with this moon god business. The idea is that the moon god is the god of war, and that illustrates that the god of Islam is the god of war. I don't think you need to go into this kind of speculation to establish that the god of Islam is a god of war. All you have to do is read the Quran itself, which says that the god of the Quran is over the moon, is the in charge of the moon, and is thus not the moon god as such, but also clearly a god of belligerence, a god of war, a god of bloodshed. That shines forth from every page of the Quran. And the second question, does the Quran say that Muslims should not take Jews and Christians as friends? Yes, that's chapter 5, verse 51.
So someone says, I have a friend who's a Muslim. What's going on there?
Well, what's going on is the same kind of thing that goes on when you have Christians who don't obey all the teachings of the Christian religion. People are people everywhere, and human nature is everywhere the same. And so there's no assumption on my part, and there should not be anybody assuming, that all Muslims are going to do everything that the Quran teaches in every detail, in every situation. People will naturally gravitate toward other people and make friends, and those friends will sometimes cross over lines of belief and creed, and sometimes those friendships may be something that's strictly forbidden by the Quran, but that's not going to stop any individual Muslim from pursuing it, because the law in every religion is the law is one thing, and the teaching of the religion is one thing, whereas the practice and the way in which every individual obeys those religious teachings is quite another.
What kind of passages will we not be, from the Quran, will we not be hearing recited, at least in English? You said it may well be said in Arabic, in English, at this Friday gathering of Muslims in Washington, D.C.?
That if they're going to be careful about what non-Muslims may hear, then they're likely not to be reciting passages that mandate warfare against unbelievers and which treat them with hatred and contempt. They are likely to be reciting passages that have to do with tolerance and peace, because the Quran contains both. Now, unfortunately, Islamic theologians teach that the violent passages and the supremacist passages actually take precedence over the peaceful passages, but those peaceful passages are in the Quran, and so I think that if they have any kind of public relations savvy, those are the ones we're going to be hearing on Friday.
Somebody says, look, we're talking about a very small minority in the United States. This will be probably a small gathering compared to others. We shouldn't be concerned. I mean, this is our obsession over Islam goes along with the 8 years since 9/11, and it's really an insignificant thing in American culture and society and politics.
Well, the 9/11 attack was not insignificant. That was 3,000 American civilians killed by Islamic jihadists. Are Islamic jihadists still in the United States? Certainly. Are they a minority of Muslims? Certainly. Does that mean that they're an insignificant one to which we should pay no attention? I think that would be naive. There were 8 years between the 1993 World Trade Center attack and the 2001 one that was successful. And so we shouldn't think that just because there has been 8 years that therefore we're out of the woods and nothing to worry about from this group. Unfortunately, history shows that that's not the case. Also, the fact, as I show in this book about the Quran, the fact that the teachings of warfare and of violence and supremacism are part of Islamic teaching, are things that that have to do with the core teachings of Islam, mean that we're not necessarily dealing with something that only a tiny minority is going to be involved in. Right now it may be a tiny minority, and at another time it may end up being a much larger number, because if these things are taught in the religion, then even the peaceful adherents of the religion are always vulnerable to appeal from Islamic jihadists saying, if you want to be truly in line with what the religion teaches, then you have to get with what we're doing. And that is how Islamic jihadists recruit among peaceful Muslims.
Folks, you can purchase Robert Spencer's new book called The Complete Infidel's Guide to the Quran at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on demand, issuesetc.org. Click on demand. Robert Spencer is a regular guest, director of Jihad Watch, columnist for Human Events and Front Page Magazine, and author of 9 books on Islam, including The Complete Infidel's Guide to the Quran. Robert, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you.
When we come back from this break, we're going to spend the last 10 minutes of this hour talking with Dr. Andrew Steinman. The church remembers Jonah. Now, the church has always remembered Jonah the way Jonah is presented in Scripture, as the real deal, as an actual person in history. Now, it's not easy to locate him always in history, in geography, but he did really exist. Jesus certainly regarded Jonah as an actual human being that existed in history. The events of this short book in the Old Testament as reliable history, at least of Jonah's encounter with the great fish and preaching of repentance to Nineveh. That's how Jesus regarded it. Of course, nowadays, it's quite popular to think of Jonah as a myth, as a legend, as an interesting parable in the Old Testament to teach us something. When we come back, we'll remember the historical Jonah. Dr. Andrew Steinman of Concordia University Chicago will be our guest. 1-877-623-6943. Talk back at issuesetc.org or Twitter us at issuesetc. It's Tuesday afternoon, September the 22nd. Stay tuned.
Here's an easy way for you to publicize Issues Etc. at your church. Go to the promote page of our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find a short paragraph to include in your weekly church bulletin. Help inform your fellow parishioners about Issues Etc. issuesetc.org. Click promote and copy and paste the text for your church secretary or pastor to include each week in the Sunday bulletin. We update this paragraph weekly. Go to the promote page of our website, issuesetc.org.
Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville, Illinois is happy to support the Christ-centered, cross-focused ministry of Issues Etc. Join us for worship, Bible classes, youth ministry, and other opportunities to grow in Christ. We have a Christian day school for children in preschool to 8th grade. We are located at 1300 Beltline Road. Call us at 618-344-3151 or visit www.goodshepherdcollinsville.org.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most radio talk shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener supported. We rely on you to pay for the production, salary, and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to consider making a tax-deductible gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio. The address? LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend on you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc. Thanks for your consideration.